from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. As the world continues to hold its collective breath over what will happen with the unfolding nuclear disaster in Japan, there is a parallel humanitarian crisis that has received less attention in recent days. 500,000 Japanese have been evacuated from the earthquake and tsunami-ravaged landscape, tens of thousands still without adequate shelter, as many as 100,000 children have been displaced. All of this in a well-off and well-organized society that had seemingly done everything possible to prepare for a natural disaster. In the hour ahead, we'll get the latest on the humanitarian situation in Japan and explore what the role of international relief efforts should be. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. It's now just a little past one on Saturday morning in Japan, another day of high anxiety. But while much of Japan's and the world's attention has been focused on the unfolding nuclear disaster, there is, of course, ongoing concern about basic humanitarian needs. Food, supplies, gasoline, shelter all remain critical areas of need in the northern part of Japan. There are also mental health concerns, worries for both the elderly and for children. And above all of it is hovering the compounding issue of nuclear radiation. NHK, the Japanese Broadcast Corporation, is reporting today that thousands of Japanese citizens living outside the official evacuation area near the crippled nuclear reactors are now moving west, which will in turn intensify various needs, including, of course, the need for temporary shelter. So this morning on Forum, we want to take up the humanitarian side of this story and find out about what the situation is in Japan and what the role of international aid should be. Joining us to do that, Joel Charney. He's Vice President of Humanitarian Policy and Practice for Interaction, which is a leading alliance of U.S.-based international non-governmental organizations. Mr. Charney, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Joining us, too, is Rebecca Milner. She's Vice President of Institutional Advancement for the International Medical Corps, which is a U.S.-based international non-governmental organization operating in some 28 countries. They deployed a team to Japan the day after the earthquake and tsunami. Rebecca Milner, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Jeff Patterson joins us as well. He's a physician and professor of public health at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, specializing in the area of public health. He's also studied the situation in nuclear disasters such as the one in Chernobyl. Jeff Patterson, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Dave. Nice to speak to you again.
It is, after all these years. I worked with Jeff many years ago. Happy to have all of you here. We're going to start, though, with a view from Japan. A little bit earlier today, I spoke with Nan Buzard, who is the Senior Director of International Response and Programs at the American Red Cross. She's in Tokyo, and she'd just gotten back from a recent trip to the far northern part of Japan, talking about and viewing those most affected areas. Here's what she had to say.
We wanted to travel much farther north than where a lot of people have been going, which is Sendai. Sendai was greatly affected by the tsunami, but we were keen to get to the north to smaller towns on the coast that had been more isolated to see what kind of support was getting in and what the needs were. So we focused on a town called Utuchi.
And what did you see there?
Well, it was pretty staggering devastation. First, we drove down from the mountains in a snowstorm. It was very, very cold. And we were coming through a town on the way to the coast, and it was really a completely kind of normal town with parking lots and apartment buildings. And literally, within 10 feet, we all of a sudden were surrounded by cars that were tossed on their back, mud, some buildings just shattered. It's just literally like a wave where it goes right up to where it stops, and then that's it. It's literally a line in the sand. It's really unlike any other kind of disaster.
It sounds like a scene of utter and complete devastation, that within that zone, really, it sounds like nothing survived.
Well, we went down literally to the coast, and we did walk through a community and meet some people who had survived and were cleaning out their houses. This town had a population of about, we think, 16,000. Of that 16,000, there are about 7,000 in evacuation centers. They found about 250 bodies so far, but it means that thousands of people are missing and they don't have information about them. And I think we're going to see the death toll really go up significantly higher than what the official toll is.
And in terms of the needs that you're seeing, Nan Buzard, what came through to you? What is the state of people's shelter, the state of the amount of food they're receiving? What humanitarian needs are foremost at this point within those most devastated areas?
Well, first, there are some areas that we have heard that still have not been reached, and these are truly, truly isolated communities where they're completely cut off by road with bridges collapsed, and the only access is by helicopter. And I think that I wouldn't say it's a search and rescue anymore, but there is humanitarian aid, I think, getting up there now. But what we saw, it was really profoundly sad because you see these people who have spent their lives being a well-prepared and disciplined society, who had thought they were in a safe place, who had prepared for a tsunami of about a 7.0 magnitude, that had tsunami warning signs all over the town, that had built up embankments, that really had done everything right, and were completely overwhelmed by this 30-foot wall of water. The town that we visited was on what appeared to be a sheltered bay, but that clearly that bay funneled the water so that it came in with an extraordinary force. The people who we saw in the evacuation centers were mostly elderly. That part of Japan is relatively kind of working class, fishing villages, elderly people. It's a very sad sight. There's no heat because there's no fuel. So people are cold. The rooms are very, very cold. And even though there's a lot of blankets and there was a small kerosene heater, it was very cold inside the rooms. They do have food now, not a lot, but certainly, you know, they're not starving, but it's certainly not an environment that you want anyone in, and particularly not the elderly.
And what would you say are the greatest needs then at this point? If people's food needs are at least being met marginally, what are the kinds of aid that has to be delivered at this point that is of the greatest concern to you?
Well, we know that already. Literally every 24 hours, it gets better, just like it always is in a disaster where the logistics fully kick in and the supply chain runs. And so I think we're going to see a lot more fuel and food and water. One of the biggest challenges here, it's kind of the opposite ends of the spectrum. On one end is, I think, a great need for psychosocial support, and I don't mean, you know, deep psychiatry, just a kind of one-on-one social work, just to give people someone who's listening to them, because people are so shattered, and that can only be done from one Japanese to another. That's not an international response. And then you're going to have an enormous need for shelter, whether it's transitional shelter or new homes, because you cannot keep hundreds of people inside gymnasiums for weeks and months on end. That's untenable. I mean, school has to begin again, and these people can't be living cheek and jowl with each other. So the shelter is going to be a huge need.
Is there enough assistance within Japan, or is there, even though there is this idea that this is a country that was well prepared, is there still a great need for international assistance?
Look at international assistance is in a broad sweep, which is everything from political and moral support to financial aid, then I would say yes, there is a need for international support. Unlike Haiti, where I've certainly spent a lot of time in the last year, there is a highly functioning government. There is great infrastructure. There are plenty of goods to purchase here. There is not the profound poverty that you have in Haiti. So in that way, it is not the same situation at all. But in terms of just absolute devastation and staggering loss, absolutely.
Nan Buzard is Senior Director of International Response and Programs for the American Red Cross. She joined us this morning from Tokyo. Nan Buzard, thanks very much, and thanks for the work that you're doing.
Dave, thank you. Good night.
Nan Buzard again with the American Red Cross. We spoke late last night, Japan time, or rather late. It's difficult sometimes to get the timing straight, but that was late Friday night. It is now early Saturday morning in Japan. She spoke to us from Tokyo about her recent trip to the far northern part of the country. Let's pick up now on some of the things she had to say. Joel Charney, first from the Interaction Agency, where you're vice president of humanitarian policy and practice. One of the things that Nan Buzard said that was striking to me is when she said it's such a profoundly sad situation, not only, of course, because of the immense amount of devastation and loss of human life, but as she put it, this is a country that seemingly was well prepared, that these were people who had spent so much time being ready for a natural disaster. You still see the tsunami signs there in that area where she was. Give us some sense of the, I guess, both the irony and what the needs are when you have this situation where a country that was seemingly well prepared has now been devastated and what that means in terms of the international response.
Yeah, I think the way this is unfolded is interesting for precisely that reason, in the sense that there was a stage where, say, within 24 or 48 hours, I think collectively we were almost comfortable saying, you know, the Japanese people were prepared, they're resilient, it's one of the wealthiest societies in the world. And there was almost a sense that, in a way, we were collectively kind of minimizing the damage almost, I feel, in retrospect, looking back over the last week. And as the scenes of the destruction have been, you know, in other words, beyond the initial waves, but as we've seen the impact and the kinds of situations that Nan described, it's obvious that this was just an immense emergency and with immense destruction. And right now we're in a situation where I think we're all trying to figure out, you know, to what extent is there real Japanese capacity to respond to this? I think it's substantial. And to what extent, you asked exactly the right question, to what extent is international support actually needed? And my view, at least from long distance and listening to what members are saying, is that there is a clear need for international financial support with Japanese institutions and Japanese partner organizations obviously in the lead in terms of organizing and mobilizing the actual response.
Joel Charney with Interaction, an alliance of U.S.-based international non-governmental organizations. Rebecca Milner, at the International Medical Corps, you have a team there now. What are you seeing in terms of what's needed and what the international assistance that ought be provided and how it would, I guess, fit then what the particular needs are?
Sure. Well, our team is also north of Sendai, and we're in two towns. One was Matsushima, and then the other town a little further east was East Matsushima. And that town was an agricultural and industrial town of about 43,000 people. And the area is completely devastated, and parts of the land have dropped 2 feet and are underwater now. Most of the buildings have been completely leveled, and there's no electricity or water supply. There are only 14,000 people in the evacuation centers in this town of 43,000. Most of the rest of them are missing. And so, again, as both Nan and Joel said, it's the search and rescue part is probably over, and it's recovery and trying to restore normal life, I guess, to a certain extent. But we are finding severe shortages of food and water and medicines for management of chronic diseases there's going to be a need there. And so International Medical Corps decided to respond because of the sheer scope and magnitude of this disaster. And we're being very careful to make sure that we're there to support the Japanese authorities and local non-governmental organizations. We started out meetings in Tokyo, meeting with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Ministry of Health, and the World Health Organization, all of whom were welcoming of our offer of support and coordination and assistance. And we have supplies prepositioned and are ready to go in. We'll be coordinating with the Japanese government and the U.S. government and making sure that those supplies can be distributed and, you know, where we can add value.
One of the things, sorry to jump in, but one of the things that's a bit ironic in some ways about this situation, again, unlike Haiti, is as Nan Buzard was describing, the devastation was so utter and complete that very few people survived within those areas that have great medical needs. As I understand it, there are actually plenty of available hospital beds in Sendai that there aren't necessarily great medical needs. So in terms, again, of what people should focus on as far as relief that's needed, it's really not so much in the pure medical emergency need. Is that correct?
For acute trauma, that is correct. That's correct. Primary health care needs are still there, as well as psychosocial support. I think that that's where the health system is going to need some additional support, is dealing with all of these people that have been displaced,
right,
and providing them with the level of primary care that they need, access to medicines.
Let me bring our primary care physician into this, and also someone who has looked at the mental health consequences of situations like Chernobyl, and that's Dr. Jeff Patterson, who is a professor of public health at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, studied the situation in Chernobyl. Jeff Patterson, what are you thinking about right now in terms of the particular medical needs as they are oriented towards mental health in particular, based on what you've learned from the Chernobyl situation?
Well, I think the immediate physical thing is protecting people with iodine in the areas where radiation is coming. And in terms of the psychosocial things, it's very hard to imagine the difficulty people at Chernobyl experienced when they were told 3 days after the accident that they were to come and get on buses and that they had to leave all their belongings in place. And of course, at that time, didn't know, but they were never coming back. If you came and got on the bus with a suitcase, it was thrown on the ground. And so I suspect similar things may be happening in the more heavily irradiated areas. Again, the psychosocial aspect of that, leaving your home, not knowing whether you'll ever come back. And I think it's compounded in Japan with the fact that Japan has already experienced severe radiation injuries, and that I think is emblazoned upon the Japanese psyche. And I think this will be sort of a reawakening of post-traumatic stress syndrome types of things.
Going back to World War
II.
With
it. That's correct, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jeff Patterson, how does what you know about these situations inform what Nan Buzard was talking about, that those particular needs, though, mental health needs in particular, can really only be provided by Japanese to Japanese? Does that make sense to you based on your experience as well?
Absolutely. I think there's subtleties of language, subtleties of knowing cultures that I, as an American doctor, would not have any clue about. And so I think the only thing we can do is provide support information from other incidents of how that was dealt with. And frankly, it's been dealt with very inadequately.
Yeah. As we think about going forward from this point and what the American response ought to be, in particular, Joel Charney, there was a story on NPR this morning that said that so far Americans have given something like $87 million, which sounds like a lot, is a lot, but actually a small amount compared to what was given in the immediate aftermath of Haiti, for example, for understandable reasons, in part because of what we've been talking about, that Japan is so much more able to contend with this than a nation like Haiti. But where should people's good consciences and intent go at this point?
Yeah, what I've been saying is basically the best thing to do in this situation is to give cash donations to reputable organizations that can demonstrate to the donor satisfaction that they have meaningful relations with Japanese partner organizations. In other words, I don't think this is about an organization that might normally mobilize, tens or even hundreds of volunteers to go. It's not about shipping stuff because there's plenty of material in Japan. Obviously, that right now the difficulty is more transport and related to logistics than the sheer lack of availability of supply. So to me, Interaction's website, interaction.org, has a list of American NGOs, organizations that meet our performance standards, and each of them has a description of what they're doing and what their plans are. And I think there is enough information there, either on our site or on the site of an individual organization, for a donor to be able to say, well, this sounds like it makes sense to me, or this is an organization that clearly has a partner in Japan that they're going to be working with. And I think applying that just basic criterion and then providing funding to that organization, to me, that's the most effective way. And I know there's a sense of, oh, that's so crass, we're just giving money, or how do I really get involved? But I mean, in this case, I really think the simplest thing is the best thing.
And there's also, Jill Charney, this part of ongoing debate about the role of non-governmental organizations in crisis situations. As you know, there was lots of debate about how that aid has been applied in Haiti. There's a lot of frustration within many Haitian organizations about international NGOs just coming in and doing what they do and not necessarily working in sync with the Haitian people. Is there a cautionary tale from that that does apply here, even though Japan is, of course, a much different situation?
No, I think so. And I actually have been making the point that we can sort of look back at Haiti and say, you know, yes, Japan and Haiti are vastly different, but there is food for thought to say, well, wait a second, maybe we did overrun Haitian capacity, we ignored Haitian organizations in our rush to help. And I think the our own knowledge of the strength of Japanese society is an appropriate caution, but frankly, for me, a caution that could be applied more broadly, mm-hmm. that could have been applied in Haiti. And, you know, whether the next emergency of this type is, you know, in the Philippines or in Sri Lanka or in Mozambique, you know, maybe even in places like that, the default mode shouldn't be, you know, let's, you know, send stuff, hop on a plane with tens of people. Let's look carefully at really what capacity is available locally and think very carefully about how we can support that. I mean, it's obviously a dilemma because sometimes the local capacity just isn't strong enough. But I think to apply a Japan model elsewhere, in my view, is something that we should all be thinking about.
Jill Charney, Vice President of Humanitarian Policy and Practice at Interaction. He joins us along with Rebecca Milner from the International Medical Corps, Jeff Patterson, Professor of Public Health at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine. We're going to take a break in a moment. When we return, we'll take your phone calls on this subject. If you have questions about what's going on right now in Japan, where aid ought to be directed, what people in this country can or should not do, we would welcome that conversation. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. When we come back, we'll also talk more about how this situation with an unfolding nuclear disaster compounds everything. And just give us a suggestion of that, Jeff Patterson, before we go to our break, because that overlays everything. We have people moving now who might not move. It really makes all of this situation very complicated and, in a way, a great unknown, because we've never really tried to do this before in this circumstance. Is that right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think nuclear disasters are very different from other disasters in that you can't see, feel, taste, or smell radiation, so you really don't know where it is. So it has a kind of an unseen fear that the other disasters don't have. And so to lay that on top of the physical disaster of the tsunami, I think, is a truly horrific situation, attempting to manage the unmanageable.
Dr. Jeff Patterson at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Again, here's our number, 866-733-6786, if you want to join us. Perhaps you've worked for a humanitarian organization before in a crisis zone. What did you learn from that circumstance? What is it that you think people ought to focus on as we move forward from here? 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the humanitarian situation in Japan, what the needs are, what we in this country can do to assist. Joel Charney joins us. He's Vice President of Humanitarian Policy and Practice at Interaction. Rebecca Milner from the International Medical Corps. Jeff Patterson, a physician and an expert on the impact of nuclear disasters on public health. And we want to get an additional voice into our conversation now before we go to your calls as well. This is Tets Nagamoto. He has organized an organization called Save Our Sendai. He is from the Sendai area, and he is bringing together a grassroots organization to try to help the people in his hometown of Sendai. Tets Nagamoto, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity.
Tell us where you are right now and what you're doing to try to bring help to your hometown.
I'm currently in Nagano City, which is a central part of Japan. This will be one of the points where we're trying to kind of gather various goods that we would want to supply to the areas that are devastated by the quake and the tsunami.
And what is your sense of what's needed most? What is it that you're trying to bring to your hometown of Sendai?
Actually, it really depends on which areas you're talking about. So, like, for instance, in some parts of Sendai, water has come back, whereas in others, gas has. But then in other parts, electricity has come back. But those diverse needs have to be assessed, and I guess the support that we're providing has to be fine-tuned to the local situation there.
What's your view? We've been talking on this program about how much international aid is needed, or whether or not the situation in Japan is that the country has been well enough prepared to contend with a crisis, even one of this magnitude. What's your sense of that? Do you think there is a need for more international assistance?
We would very much hope so. I do believe that Japan was the country best prepared for this type of disasters. However, this was really big. This was overwhelming, and although we would have difficulty locally in accepting many of the aids that are coming in, we believe those situations will be solved as time passed by. And we would very much accept whatever offer that can be given to us, and we'd be grateful for them.
One of the things that has come up as we've talked about at this hour of our program are the future needs for mental health, that people who have been displaced, who have lost their homes, you have overlaying that, this now great concern over the potential impact of nuclear fallout radiation. What's your view on that? And the people you've talked to in Sendai, where you lived previously, what's your sense of the sort of state of people's overall mental health?
From what I gather, it is extremely difficult there, partly because one of the main reasons is because there still are cadavers that are not collected. And you see them in sight. And so, and even the rescue teams who have more or less been used to seeing deaths have been overwhelmed by the sight of the victims. And so I would think that the devastation in terms of psychological impact is quite huge. And we in Japan would all need to concentrate our resources on that mental health aspect as well.
Tets Nagamoto, he's the founder of a grassroots group called Save Our Sendai. He is trying to organize help for people, former students, former people who've lived there, to come together to deliver healthcare supplies and other supplies to the people of Sendai. Tets Nagamoto, thank you for joining us. Best of luck as you proceed with your efforts to help, and I hope you are able to do whatever is possible to help the people of your hometown of Sendai. Thanks very much for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate your support.
Tets Nagamoto. Rebecca Milner, when you heard Tets Nagamoto describe the sort of state of almost shock that he feels many people are in, give us some sense of how you think that your group, the International Medical Corps, or others can assist in this, because, again, this seems to be something that can best happen Japanese to Japanese. So is there a role that can be supportive in this area that really seems to be one that will be particularly acute in the days ahead?
Well, we do think so. I mean, there is the scale of, as everyone is saying, is overwhelming. And we have found in our experience that providing psychological first aid and, you know, supporting mental health efforts is critically important during these traumatic events like this. And we feel that International Medical Corps and a lot of other NGOs that have worked in these humanitarian crisis situations have a lot to offer. And there are going to be frontline healthcare workers or volunteers that are going to be dealing with a lot of people that have been affected by this. And they could probably use support in knowing how to provide psychological first aid and mental health support. So we see that that's possible area where we can add value.
And Jeff Patterson, add into that, if you can, about the difficulty of this circumstance, not only sort of culture to culture, but also if part of what's needed is to provide a sense of reassurance and stability for people who have gone through this sort of crisis, who have been displaced, how do you do that? How do you provide that when you're not really entirely sure what the future is going to hold, when there is all this anxiety about the potential impact of radiation in particular? What have you learned from your past studies about that?
Well, I think the important thing is just caring, listening, being empathetic. All of those things can be beneficial, because people feel totally adrift and totally lost. So having someone come in who can at least, again, provide an empathetic listening ear, even though you may not know what's going to happen, I think the sense that we are a group working on this together is extremely important in the near term.
And let's take some of our listener calls on this subject. We'll go to Mark first in San Francisco. Mark, go ahead, please.
Hi there. My name's Mark Kasula. I'm in San Francisco, and I'm actually a Japanese-speaking American business person. Thank you so much for having Mr. Nagamoto from Nagano on the line there. It's valuable to us to hear him speak from there. And I once lived in Nagano a very long time ago. As we talk about the AIDS and the NGOs and the different ways that we can send and support them, I have learned over the last week that my very simple grassroots approach of reaching out to everyone in my Rolodex, both personally and professionally, and just giving them one communication of support with no request for a reply, either a telephone or an email or text along the way, and occasionally Skyping, just to tell them that we do support you, and if you need anything, ask. I have been moved by the response from people who I talk to regularly and who I haven't spoken to for years, just to know that they really are affected positively by our support in an emotional way, rather than sometimes an approach that might show up as, well, I don't know what to say, so I'm going to wait and see. I think if we reach out personally, individually, in all of our own communities, and touch those people in Japan whom we do know, I think it will make a significant difference in the whole move.
Terrific reminder, Mark. Thanks. Thanks for offering that one way we can all be of assistance is to not wait in that regard, but to reach out and offer those one-on-one communications. Joel Charney, anything you want to add to Mark's comment?
Well, I had an experience this week that really resonated with what Mark said. We did that very thing person to person to the counterpart organization of Interaction in Japan, which is called JANIC. And again, for those of you who don't know Interaction, we're a membership organization of organizations involved in international work. There's a similar body in Japan. And one of our staff people just did that very thing, reached out on a personal level to the two or three JANIC staff that she knew and just basically said, you know, we're thinking of you. Is there anything we can do? Any support we can provide? You know, we offered to provide English translation potentially to help them beef up their website a little bit. But the initial back and forth was very much at a personal level rather than a professional level. And, you know, while I don't know Japanese culture all that well, I mean, it was evident from the exchange that they really appreciated that that reaching out.
And to Joe, who joins us this morning on the Sirius Satellite Network from Houston, Texas. Joe, go ahead. Joe, go ahead. You're on the air. Joe, are you with us?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
1 second. Have to call you back.
All right, Joe. If you have a comment, we'd like to hear from you. You can join us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. If you have a call for our panel today about the humanitarian situation in Japan, questions about what you can do to be helpful, we welcome them at 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments there. One of the things that Nan Buzard said at the beginning of our program, Rebecca Milner, that I had not heard, though it makes perfect sense, which she said that there are some areas that we have not reached yet, that there are parts that are isolated in northern Japan that we haven't been able to reach yet. Is that your understanding as well? So I guess what I'm asking about is, are we still going to learn a lot more, that this disaster has reached places that we still don't really have any idea about?
I think that that is true. Early reports from our team on the ground are that it's local authorities that are managing this disaster. And because they've been cut off with no cell service, no electricity, phone lines are down, I think we are going to find pockets of communities that have not been reached. And we, in Matsushima and East Matsushima, we didn't see any UN or NGO presence or significant civil society presence in those towns.
Email coming in from Catherine in Mountain View, who writes, I was a Peace Corps trainee in Corpus Christi, Texas, when Hurricane Andrew hit back in 1980. We were enlisted to help in the shelters for those who needed to evacuate. Along those lines, my question is, there is a naval base, or there have been other naval bases nearby in Japan. What is the U.S. military doing to help? Is there a role for the American presence already in Japan to assist in that capacity? Jill Charney, can you respond to that? There was this, and maybe Jeff Patterson, you want to chime in on this as well, because there's been concern about American presence as far as the radiation danger. The aircraft carrier Ronald Reagan actually turned back because of concern over radiation. What do you know right now, Joel Charney, about U.S. military presence? And then Jeff Patterson, maybe you can weigh in on what the concerns can or should be about that sort of radiation exposure. Joel Charney?
Yes, thanks, Dave. I'm not sure what's happening on the kind of person-to-person level that the questioner was curious about. I mean, I know that the military is providing significant logistical support through, you know, things like helicopters and other transport assistance and so on. But to what extent, you know, U.S. soldiers already in Japan are kind of side by side with their Japanese counterparts, you know, helping go through the rubble and things like that. I'm not really sure what the situation is there.
Jeff Patterson, on this question of how safe it is, one of the things that's been troubling over the last 48 hours is that differing views of that have come forward. The official evacuation zone around the Fukushima plant established by Japan is 12 miles. Within 20 miles, you should stay inside. But the Nuclear Regulatory Commission assessment was that the evacuation zone should be much larger, and the American embassy has said that people within 50 miles should be removed. And if you went with that larger figure, it means that perhaps the danger is greater. Give us some sense of your read right now on what the radiation dangers are within that closer proximity.
Well, I think this points up the difficulty of a situation like this and the fact that the unknowns are far greater than the knowns, and both coordinating and understanding what the need is practically impossible. So you're going to get these conflicting reports. It doesn't mean that one group is right or wrong. It just means that there are different assessments being made of it in a very difficult situation. I've seen differing reports about the radiation levels, and so I don't think we have have a clear idea about that. We have written to the administration asking them to release the accurate levels of both what kinds of nucleides are being released and how much, because they're flying drone airplanes over the area to attempt to map out what's there. Part of the difficulty with this is that radiation doesn't spread equally, and so one area fairly close to another may have a higher level, or when it rains, it'll concentrate in puddles on the sidewalk, for example, so that even if we have some general idea, there may still be hot spots and cold spots. And so, again, it's a very difficult situation, and I think the prudent thing to do is to move people out, because we don't know what more is going to come out of this plant, and perhaps planning for the worst case is a better way to go, because if it happens and you haven't done it, then you're in much bigger trouble than if you take these steps ahead of time.
So is that 50-mile, the larger zone that was recommended through the assessment by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and that the American Embassy has endorsed, 50 miles, is that sufficient?
I don't know the answer to that, and I don't believe that anybody knows. It's going to depend on wind directions. It's going to depend on exactly what happens at the plant, that probably more than anything else. This problem is probably not going to go away soon. We may be dealing with this for days or weeks to come, depending on how much of the cooling services they can reinstitute at the plant, and then how much damage has been done to the cores and to the cooling systems that are supposed to flood the cores.
And while we're on the subject, I should just ask for your medical assessment of any risk here on the West Coast of the United States. As you know, there's been lots of anxiety about that, people going out and buying those iodine tablets. The medical advice seems to be, with some unanimity, that this is not cause for great concern, even though the first bit of radiation is now expected to drift on into Southern California today. Do you concur with that overall assessment, that the amount at this point is so small that people should really not be anxious here on the West Coast of the United States?
Well, I guess there are a couple answers to that. I think, first of all, there is no safe dose of radiation, so that I think we should have anxiety about radiation in general. However, the likely amount is small, and I think we need to know accurate information about how much iodine is in it versus how much cesium is in it, because iodine would necessitate not drinking milk, not eating fresh vegetables that have the iodine in them or on them, and protecting children with and pregnant women and lactating women with iodine prophylaxis. But again, having said that, I think it's likely that this will be small amounts, but we just don't know, because we don't know what's, again, going to come out of the plant. If there's an explosion and it's lofted higher into the atmosphere, then more may drift across the ocean. And so this is a very difficult situation.
Dr. Jeff Patterson joining us.
Let me just add one thing. In China, I just heard now a reporter told me that the Chinese are stripping the shelves of salt because they believe that salt will protect their thyroids. And so there's panic buying of salt in China, which is probably unlikely to get any radiation. So it just shows the psychological effect of this incident and the unknowns about radiation.
And let's take another caller. Peter joins us next. Peter, go ahead with your comment or question.
Oh, yeah, thanks. I'm sorry if I missed this earlier, but I have a couple of questions, if I may. One being a report in yesterday's either Journal or New York Times that monetary donations are not being allowed in because the government has not asked for it, and I don't know what the politics or legalities of that, but that's made me hold back from donating money. And then my more important question follows on a comment I just heard as I tuned in. One of your women guests said something about mental health support. How would someone like myself, who has extensive mental health training and some disaster training, be able to help out, given that I don't speak Japanese?
Peter, thanks for the call. Let's see if we can get some answers. Joel Charney, can you take the first part of his question about any limitations that you're aware of on donations going to Japan?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any limitations whatsoever. I think our member organizations that are accepting donations have been able, say, if they have an affiliate in Japan, to transfer the funds to that affiliate without any difficulty whatsoever. So unless I've completely missed something in the last 24 or 48 hours, I wouldn't be concerned about that issue.
And again, on your website, which is interaction.org, there's a list of organizations who are working in Japan and who, in the judgment of your organization, which is an alliance of a variety of international NGOs, in your judgment, these are organizations that are well-positioned to be of assistance. So interaction.org, is that right, Joel?
Yes, interaction.org, and then you'll have a Japan, a tsunami page or an earthquake page, and then at that page are listed, I think it's now between 30 and 35 organizations, and these are members who meet the standards that we've set to be, you know, basically responsible and reputable organizations.
And Rebecca Milner, any comments on Peter's other question about someone like him who has a degree of mental health training, has also worked in crisis situations? This gets in again to this question of whether or not you can be helpful, particularly in an area where cultural sensitivity is particularly important, like mental health, or whether or not at this point really the best thing to do is just send cash, even if it doesn't feel as direct as the kind of assistance that Peter would like to provide.
Right. I mean, I would certainly agree with that. I mean, the Japanese-to-Japanese assistance is going to be the primary way that mental health support is delivered. We will be working with our partners to supply them with information and learnings from our experience and experience among the wider humanitarian community that might be helpful. So there may be ways to plug in there, but we do have to put priority on supporting the local authorities and local nonprofit leaders that are going to be providing, and health workers that are going to be providing this assistance.
And to Jeffrey, next in San Francisco. Jeffrey, go ahead, please.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my phone call.
You bet.
I just wanted to fill in the gap. A few minutes ago, a caller called in asking about military presence in Japan. And I personally have my stepbrother. Is an executive officer of USS Fitzgerald, part of the 7th Fleet. And I just wanted you all to know that the 7th Fleet, virtually the entirety of the 7th Fleet, is working 24-7 on rescue operations, assisting the Japanese self-defense forces. And if you're interested in seeing actual photos from sailors and the 7th Fleet, you can actually follow them on the Facebook page. Just search U.S. 7th Fleet on Facebook. But I want to assure you that the U.S. military is deeply involved, exhausting themselves, taking care of the Japanese people.
Jeffrey, thanks. Can you also tell us something about, from your context within the 7th Fleet, what concerns there are, if there are, about radiation exposure and what's being done by the U.S. military to make sure that enlisted men and women are kept safe?
Yeah, I definitely can. So, you know, they have billion-dollar ships, multi-billion-dollar ships. So they're concerned about that, number one. I'd actually say they're concerned about their people. So they're being very cautious in that regard. I do know that they have the government is allowing voluntary evacuations of military families. So, in fact, our stepsister and her sons, his family, they're flying back soon.
Hmm.
But that's voluntary at this point. But, you know, there's real concerns there. But their primary goal is to complete their mission and provide valuable help to the ally.
Jeffrey, thanks. Thanks for bringing us that additional information. Thanks. Thanks very much.
Okay.
As we move into the last few moments of our program, let's focus in again on our sort of overarching question about what needs are and what people in this country can do to be of most assistance. Rebecca Milner, from your point of view, what would you like people like us to be thinking about or directing their wallets towards in the coming days?
Well, I mean, the earthquake and tsunami are of such a magnitude and scope that recovery is going to take a long time, and the needs are going to be significant for a long time. I mean, I believe that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce issued an estimate that it's going to cost somewhere around $200 billion on recovery efforts. So resources, support, coordination, all of those things are going to be needed for a considerable amount of time. And so I would encourage listeners to take a long view, and as they do support non-governmental organizations like International Medical Corps, that they value the fact that we as an organization are going to be supporting and coordinating and making sure that we're adding value and supporting the local Japanese health authorities and NGOs.
It's a really important point, Jeff Patterson, about taking the long view, and that this will, in part, of course, because of the nuclear part of this equation that's hovering over all of this quite literally, that this is something that we're going to have to think about and consider and bring additional assistance to for a very long time. It's not worth forgetting that Chernobyl happened 25 years ago next month, and there still obviously are ramifications from that event. So add to us, if you would, please, what our longer view ought to be.
Well, in terms of length of time, we're really talking tens and perhaps hundreds of years for some territory that may be uninhabitable and we'd be unable to grow food and crops and animals on. And again, we just don't know how large that will be, if it is at all. But because radiation is truly the forever pollution, it's quite different than Hiroshima, which was a one-time dose when the bomb went off high in the air, and essentially was a giant X-ray. There was very little fallout from that. Now we have the issue of long-term fallout, cesium with a half-life of 30 years, and we generally have to multiply that times 10 to get safety of the area when the radiation decays enough. And it looks like cesium and iodine will be the major products that will come out of this plant, but it's possible that other longer-lived products may be produced as well.
And Joel Charney, just a last thought from you as to what you'd like listeners to be considering in the days and months ahead.
I think one key thing that I wanted to bring up earlier is, in fact, the positive psychological and psychosocial benefits of the rebuilding process itself. I was in Indonesia 10 days after the tsunami, and people wanted to go back to their devastated housing site and begin the rebuilding process. And while we're only 1 week out, I think we're going to start to see that desire from the Japanese people as well, and that's something that we should all attempt to support.
Joel Charney with the International Nongovernmental Alliance Interaction joined us, along with Rebecca Milner from International Medical Corps, Jeff Patterson from the School of Medicine and Public Health at the University of Wisconsin. Earlier, we also heard from Tets Nagamoto from his Save Our Sendai organization, and also Nan Buzard from the American Red Cross. Thanks all very much for your participation in our program. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.